This is Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James.
Welcome to another episode of Golf Nuts. Hey, Aaron, how are you today? We've got a really good friend of yours that's going to drop in and chat with us. Seems like a very interesting very skilled fellow, skilled at what he does, writing, has written several books or so. But why don't you tell our audience about Mark Whitaker and who he is and how you know him?
Well, I'll start before I introduce him to just say that we're going to release this during Black History Month. And we've tried to make a little bit of tradition on the show of doing something a little bit interesting, a little slightly race related, something celebrating Blacks and golf during Black History Month. And if you haven't listened to it, I really enjoyed our podcast in the previous season with Renee Powell. That was awesome. And it just pull that thing up from the vault and listen to it. But she has an incredible story. Today's guest is my friend, Mark Whitaker, who I know through golf. He has this impeccable resume, which I'm definitely going to mess up. But he was the editor of Newsweek. And he also served as the NBC Washington bureau chief and was the managing editor of CNN. He since sort of retired, and he's now an author. He does some sort of side projects on with media, occasionally writing for Golf Digest or doing work for CBS Sunday Morning Show. He does some segments for them. Really interesting guy. Really happy that he's joining us. He was, I think according to Wikipedia, the first African American to lead a national news magazine. So in 1998. As recent as that, there had not been an African American leading a national news magazine, and he was the first. Before we bring him in, and not to steal his thunder, I have to thank our sponsor for giving us the financial tools to get us through the season and just pay for all the little incidentals that we have here on the podcast. I'm not trying to make a living here, but Arcos is super kind. Our friends at Arcos. We're going to give them a little shout out. They are our sponsor for season 3. Arcos, as you guys know, because everyone's been listening all season and everyone knows Arcos, is the little thingy that you stick inside the golf club grip, and it helps you figure out how far you're hitting your clubs. If you haven't checked it out yet, you should. We have a little bit of a deal, 15% off. If you get on the Arcos site and you type in golf nuts, get a little deal. Check it out. And with that, let's bring on Mark Whitaker.
One more thing on Arcos, in that I got my set of sensors, and I'm really looking forward to using them because it lets you know where you end up a lot of times on with all your shots. And so it's really a great game improvement tool. I got a new set of PXGs for Christmas. Ooh. And I just got an email from them today that the custom set has been completed. And as soon as I get them, I am going to sync my sensors to all 14 clubs. And so I'm really looking forward. I'm really looking forward to that and using. So I'm going to use Arcos this entire season, and we'll see how much it improves my game.
And all of us up here in the North are just absolutely jealous that you can even like talk about golf right now, because it's so freezing up here that you can't even imagine. But anyway, let's bring on Mark, and I'm looking forward to this conversation. Welcome to Golf Nuts with Aaron Abrams and Jimmy James. We are thrilled to have in our virtual studio today Mark Whitaker. For those of you guys who have been listening along the three seasons, we try to do a nod to Black History Month and do something maybe a little bit about inclusion in golf, about folks who have, you know, who are of color and play golf. And we just had a chat about golf. We're not quite sure exactly the direction that these things take, but Mark is, I'm going to botch it, So I'm glad he's here on the call. First of all, it's very stressful because his background is he's a journalist. He's a friend of mine. I watch him on Sunday morning, the shows where he like interviews Cory Booker. And I mean, he's a real journalist. But at different points in his career, you effectively, you know, were the main head of the content at CNN. I'm going to botch that. That's like, but, and then you also had that same role at Newsweek, right? Like you were, I don't know what the official term is, publisher.
Well, I was the editor of Newsweek and then I was the managing editor of CNN.
And occasionally Mark and I play golf together. And occasionally his locker is like one or two aisles over from me. And I'll just think that the TV is on, that someone has CNN on, but he's actually just talking to some other member. And but the words come out and it just sounds like perfect. You don't have awkward pauses like I do in your phone, in the way that you speak. Your cadence is excellent. I wanted to get started by asking you about this. Remember that article that you wrote, which I pulled up deep on Google. It was about your experience before you joined a private golf course in New York area and about your experience with public golf. And I think where were you playing mostly?
Van Cortlandt Park.
I played at Van Cortlandt. I played at Moshaloo. I played at Spook Rock up in Rockland County.
And the Spook Rock one, Aaron, that there's an interesting MT story about that one, twist about that one, isn't it?
Well, LT, you mean LT?
I said MT.
Yeah.
LT, there's a...
Yeah, I told that story in that piece. Well, yeah, he used to play Spook Rock and then get into trouble. And he got busted with an underage lady of the night, I think, somewhere in that area after playing golf there.
Got it.
Yeah, I'm sure you remember that story, Aaron, back.
Yeah, I just didn't know. I didn't know the golf part. I knew the second chapter of that story better than the first, I guess. I didn't realize he was playing golf before that. But tell us a little bit, I mean, if you remember, like, I mean, it's been maybe a year or so since I glanced at that article, but the general gist, and I think it's good as a sort of starting place about what we're going to talk about today, was just your experience and the diversity that you experienced there and kind of the quirkiness that you experienced just being a regular looper at those public facilities.
Well, actually, the first public course I played on was up in Kingston, New York, a little 9-hole public course right in the middle of that town. I had a little sort of cabin country house, not far from there. And this is the summer of 1994, 1995. And I had just taken up golf. I took up golf because of my job at Newsweek. At a certain point, even though I was on the editorial side, I was being asked to come to ad sales events to talk about, you know, our vision for the magazine. And I discovered that like all these ad salesmen, our ad salesmen and all their clients were just golf nuts. And I sort of figured that like, you know, if I was going to hang with them, I needed to check out this game. So, you know, I took a few lessons and that's how I got into golf. And so that first summer that I was playing golf, and it was a little, you know, I had a little bit of a bad conscience about it because my dad, who had grew up in Pittsburgh, son of funeral home owners, both my grandparents in Black Pittsburgh, had shag balls during the summer, just, you know, to make money. In an all-white club where he couldn't play. So to the degree that I was aware of golf, apart from just watching it on TV growing up, you know, I had my dad's voice in my head that this was kind of like a rich white guy's sport.
Was this?
So I started playing golf and I like it, you know, I get the bug. And I'm up in the country during the summer on vacation. And I start going to this little 9-hole course in Kingston. And one day I'm there as a single. And a black gentleman walks up to the first tee. And he says, are you a single? I said, yeah, I'm a single. He said, would you like to play together? I said, sure. I said, I just taken up the game. I hope you don't mind. But he said, yeah, no problem. Anyway, so we start playing, we tee off, we're like, you know, and eventually we start asking each other what, you know, we do. And he said, well, you know, I'm a musician. I said, oh yeah, what kind of musician? He said, I'm a jazz musician. Turned out it was Jimmy Cobb. Now, if you know jazz, Jimmy Cobb was one of the great jazz drummers of all time. He's the drummer on Kind of Blue. If you know that, the Miles A. Davis album, that's the best-selling jazz album of all time. And I'm thinking like, wow, you know, Jimmy Cobb. Man, I met Jimmy Cobb. And Jimmy Cobb's a golfer. So anyway, from then on, I had like, you know, no problem playing golf. I figured if Jimmy Cobb can play golf, I don't have to feel guilty about playing this game.
And I remember that there was another reference to a musician or to, it was one of the Beastie Boys' dads.
Yeah, that was at Van Cortlandt. So it was the father, what was his name? He was a playwright. And his son was one of the Beastie Boys.
And you just randomly got paired with him at public golf.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, that was the thing that was cool, I thought, as a journalist, about playing on public courses, and usually I at Newsweek we closed the magazine. It went to the printers on Sunday, so I worked all day Saturday, and my weekend was Sunday and Monday. So I got to play golf on Monday. It's another reason I could play these public courses. Was, you know, as you know, on the weekends they're insane. You know, you have to wait forever, and then it's a 6-hour round. But on Monday, it's not bad. So I would play on Mondays. And, you know, at a place like Van Cortlandt Park, you know, you roll up on a Monday morning and you could be playing with anybody. You know, I mean, I played with doormen. There are a lot of people who have like night jobs or kind of like jobs with weird hours. So, you know, there were a lot of, you know, actors, you know, doormen. There were doctors and who would show up like in their scrubs. You know, they just got off a rotation and they'd show up in their scrubs. And so in addition to playing golf, I got to, you know, talk to them, which is, you know, as a journalist, what I love to do.
What time period was this? Was this in the 60s? How old were you when you started doing
that? No. I started playing, well, no, this is in the 90s because, you know, I'm 64 now. And I took up golf in 1994. So what's that, 26 years ago, I was already in my 40s, I guess, yeah. Or maybe my 30s still. And yeah, so it was, I had two golf lives. Because of my job at Newsweek, I got to play at a lot of like really good courses where the ad guys played and where we had various events. But apart from that, I played on public courses, and that lasted from 94 when I took up golf until 10 years later, 2004, I joined Quaker Ridge.
Yeah, I took up golf late in life too. I was 45 years old when I when I took up golf, and I can really relate to showing up and being paired with people. Mm-hmm. Everybody has a story, mm-hmm. and so you meet some very interesting people, mm-hmm. and you connect. And I've said this before on the podcast, but to me, it is an amazing thing how quickly familiarity between two strangers grows on a golf course. And yeah. What I've said in the past is that differences melt away under a common passion for golf.
Yeah.
Because there's something built in that you can talk about to each other on a golf course. So you mentioned a couple of very interesting people. Have you gotten stories that you've written or published based upon any of your interactions?
Yeah, so I've done I've I've done several articles for Golf Digest. So that was a one about just playing golf on public courses. I did a piece on, my last book was on the influence of the Black community of Pittsburgh in the middle of the 20th century, when Pittsburgh had the leading Black newspaper in the country and a couple of the great Negro League baseball teams and all these great jazz musicians came out of Pittsburgh. And so there were a few years there where I was going to Pittsburgh all the time. And I discovered a group of Black golfers in Pittsburgh who in the 1950s formed a club. Now, you know, they couldn't get into the, you know, Oakmont or, you know, any of the other private clubs around there. And there were a lot of public courses where they couldn't play either. But they decided that they wanted to play golf. And also they figured maybe they'd be strength in numbers. So they got together and they started like showing up at public courses with, you know, 24 guys or something ready to play or calling ahead and trying to get tee times. And over time, they actually integrated a lot of the public courses around there because a lot of these courses didn't see a lot of Black golfers. But, you know, once they heard that, like, you know, they were going to, you had 24 guys who were willing to, you know, show up and pay the fees, then they, you know, started to let them on. And they called themselves the Dandy Duffers. Anyway, so I did a piece on them and their history, and, you know, they're still together. They still play. They have a season. They sort of like, you know, go around, you know, every week they play a different course every year. And it was really interesting because they really ran the gamut. The guys I talked to from, there were, you know, a number of retirees, people who had kind of, you know, blue collar jobs or, you know, but there were also some pretty successful professionals. One of them was a, you know, a very prominent Black doctor in Pittsburgh. And I said to him, well, you know, have you been approached about joining private club? He said, all the time. He said, but you know what? These are my buddies. You know, if I go to a private club, I'm going to be like the only Black guy or one of a few Black guys, and I'll make friends. But like, this is, you know, this is a different experience. So anyway, so I wrote about that. And then I wrote another one about a piece about there is a group of, again, public course golfers, muni golfers on Long Island who play at Bethpage, you know, where they now have majors, right. The great Tillinghast course out there. And Bethpage Black. And well, they have four courses or five, maybe even.
But are the other ones Tillinghast too? The Black course is Tillinghast.
I'm not sure, but yeah. Anyway, but the Black is the famous one.
Yep.
And so before they even started playing majors there, there were a group of golfers, like very good golfers, who would like sleep in the parking lot on the weekends to get a tee time on at Bethpage Black. And they decided that they wanted to be recognized as a club, partly so they could have handicaps and they could play in, you know, amateur tournaments. And they petitioned the Met Golf Association for recognition, and they got it. So they now have, they call themselves a club without real estate. They don't own the club. They play mostly at Bethpage, but they're recognized by the Met section as a club. There are now 100 of them. You have to apply and, you know, have a sponsor and all that stuff the way you would in a private club. These guys, there are a lot of, again, they run the gamut. They're mostly white. There are a few Black members, but you know, a lot of them are either current or retired cops, firemen, small businessmen, two women. Get this, they have an average index of like 6.8.
Wow!
And a quarter of them play under two. Wow. So these guys are like, you know, they love to have fun. Afterwards, they get together, you know, they drink beer, they tell stories, you know, it's kind of what you would expect, like this very, you know, kind of, you know, Long Island, blue collar, down to earth, you know, thing. But on the golf course, these guys are the most competitive golfers I have ever seen.
That's really fun. Can I ask a question again? Apologies to you, Mark, but this is not CNN. And we're just like faking our way through an interview here. But I have a question for you for sort of along the lines of sort of Black History Month. It's actually for both you and Jimmy. And I'm curious, just as we kind of frame this conversation, what your experience is like and what are the, I'm curious, like what it's like to be African-American and show up, and the difference between the public courses that we're talking about versus private courses where you all have spent a lot of time, and also a little bit maybe of time-based experience. Like, has that changed at all in your experience over the last two decades in one way or another?
Jimmy, you want to go first?
So it's a mixed bag. When I play public courses, run into quite a number of Black golfers, and they're usually pretty good. They're usually really good for some reason. They're much better than the average golfer that I run into on the public course. And then at private courses, I belong to several private courses, and I may be the only Black member in a couple of them. And so you still have that today. And then there are a few that have a handful of Black members, but none of them have a significant number of Black members. And when I played the top 100 courses, there was only one course where I saw a Black golfer that wasn't either hosting me or a part of my group that I brought with me to the course. And that was Larry Fitzgerald at Seminole. So that was the only time in the top 100 that I saw Blacks at the course as a golfer that wasn't either hosting me or a guest of mine or a guest of my host at the course. No, I take that back. I'm sorry. There was one other course. They were hosting me. So it was, we had a Black foursome, but they were hosting me. So the golf club in New Albany. But yeah, it's changed some, but there are still clubs they won't have it written in their covenants, but they don't allow, it's understood that Blacks and Jews can play there, but they can't join. So there aren't many places now that I'm aware of that don't allow you to play, but there are still places that discriminate on race.
If there's a single place that won't allow you to play, that's a big story. I mean, right. That's a big story. And I've never seen that, but obviously I come from this like a, you know, upper class Jewish family. So white guy, but I'm actually surprised even that there are clubs that won't allow a Jewish or a Black member. And that's fascinating to hear, but let's leave that aside. Cause that's maybe there's some food to chew on there. Mark, what's your experience been?
So, the first thing I would say is I agree with what Jimmy said earlier, which is, you know, once people, there is a kind of fellowship among golfers that does cut, I've found, across racial, class, you know, lines, in the sense that, like, you know, I mean, it's there are exceptions to that, you know, of course, but I think that there is just something about people who love golf that if they see that you love golf too, that is a way of kind of breaking the ice and perhaps getting past a lot of this other stuff that people deal with, at least while you're on the golf course. I would say that I agree with Jimmy in terms of public courses. I have never played a public course, and again, I haven't played in the South, you know, except occasionally on travel if I'm like, you know, between business meetings or something, I'll sneak out. But usually those courses are, you know, kind of pretty pricey and sort of tourist destination kind of courses. But But certainly in the Northeast, where I played a lot of public courses, you know, I've never gotten the sense that I like walk in to the pro shop to like pay my, you know, to pay to get on the course, and like they've never seen a black person. You know, they do all the time. You know, because as Jimmy says, there are a lot of, you know, there are a lot of black golfers all over the country. The private courses, you know, what I would say is, you know, my experience has been that, you know, Aaron, as you know, I'm you know, when I joined at Quaker Ridge, I was one of two black members, one of whom was my sponsor, three, and now we're only two. Now we're down to two. And so in all of that time, it hasn't increased. And, you know, most of my friends, black friends who belong to private courses, it's the same deal. You know, they're one of, you know, at most a handful. And what I would say is, even at the sort of nicest clubs in terms of overall atmosphere and the nicest people, you kind of have to be willing to roll with the punches. Like you're not going to enjoy it if you have a big chip on your shoulder are looking and are waiting, you know, to take offense.
Right.
If, you know, because it's going to happen, you know. My boss at Newsweek, well, I ran the editorial side and he was the head of the business side, but he was also like, I reported to him. His name was Rick Smith, real golf nut, great guy. He invited me to his home course in New Jersey. I won't give the name because it's a little embarrassing for them, to play golf with him. I'm there on a Saturday morning, it's probably a Sunday morning because I was working on Saturday. And, you know, I'm pretty light skinned. I'm wearing my golf cap. You know, we're having breakfast before we tee off. And like a member walks up and tells like a really offensive, racist joke, black joke. And like, you know, Rick, I could see Rick's pretty pale to begin with. He got even more pale, just like, you know, and like, you know, and he didn't say anything at the time, but, you know, he afterwards, as the guy walked away, he said, I'm so sorry about that. And then the next week, you know, I showed up to work and he called me on the phone. He said, I just want you to know that I talked to the starter and like that guy is going to get a reprimand and, or not, he was a member, but you know, I guess maybe why was the starter involved? I don't know. Anyway, so stuff like that happens, you know, that hasn't happened to me at Quaker Ridge, but you know, I've had the experience at other clubs. You know, so, you know, and, you know, the other thing I would say is all private courses that I've played at, you know, I'm only a member of Quaker Ridge and a little golf course, 9-hole private golf course up in the Catskills where I go during the summer. And that's a more down to earth, you know, it's like one fee, there are no caddies, et cetera, et cetera. It's a pretty laid back atmosphere. But in those two clubs and every other private club that I know of, a lot of the members, if not most of the members, play most of the time with their group, right? You have like a regular foursome, or maybe you have like eight guys who trade off depending on who's available. And they make their tee times and they get, you know, and, you know, if you are the only black or one of the few black players at the club, by definition, you are not going to automatically probably be part of one of those groups. You know, so now, so what I found over time since I joined Quaker is, you know, at first it meant that I had to do a lot more work, you know, just to actually play, because I would kind of, you know, I wasn't necessarily setting up the times, and then I would sort of see like, you know, who had an opening. Although I've got to say over time, I think it's actually a plus in the sense that, you know, over time there are probably four or five or six groups of guys who play pretty much all the time with each other. But I've become friendly enough with all of them that I'll rotate in and play fairly frequently with all of those groups. So in some ways, I feel like, you know, I've made more friends in some ways, gotten to know more people at least, you know.
Yep.
And because partly because of the fact that, you know, I'm a not an only, but a one of two onlys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my first thing I want to say is that throughout the top 100 courses, not once was I made to feel unwelcome. I expected, honestly, a lot of people told me that I would have some issues with some clubs. I mean, I was all the way in Ireland, and this guy said to me, you got to look out for LA Country Club. They don't allow blacks and Jews. But if they don't allow blacks, Jews, and movie stars. But if you can promise me you're not a movie star, I can get you on. So there were a few clubs that people warned me about, but I actually didn't have any issues. There was one club where Oak Tree National.
Oklahoma City.
In Edmonds,
yeah, that's Edmonds,
outside
deal.
Of Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
And I pull up to the backdrop. The guy asked the backdrop attendant asked my name, and I told him, and he said, "We don't have you playing here today. We don't have you on the tee sheet." I said, "I'm fairly certain I'm on the tee sheet. I'll go check inside." And the assistant pro, who then called the pro Steve Kimball in, because Steve had been waiting on me. And the assistant pro says, "Yeah, your name's on the list. Everybody knows you're coming because so many people want to talk to you. As a matter of fact, I need to call the head pro now because he's very excited about having you here and wants to talk to you." I think the guy probably heard the guy who's playing the top 100 in a year is going to play here today. And it never occurred to him that that guy could be black. And I sense that that's not a club that gets a lot of play from blacks. The other thing I'll mention, my sort of journeyman club here in Atlanta is called Cherokee Town and Country. We've got probably, I don't know, 1,500 or so golf members. So when I joined the club, and I was sponsored by whites, when I joined the club, I was invited to join some groups. So I've been a part of several groups, but there are so many members that I show up as a single during the week quite often and just get paired with the twosome or threesome so that I can meet other members. And I've never once felt uncomfortable in a group that I've been randomly paired with at the club. It's always fun because they like to hear all the stories about playing the top 100 golf courses. They go, "Oh, you're the guy."
Yeah, right.
So that part's been good. And I agree with you also, Mark, as I said earlier, when you have this common passion for golf, there's a camaraderie that's almost instantaneous that comes from serendipitous encounters that isn't as frequent outside the golf world.
I feel like I've talked about this before on the podcast, but my worldview on some of these private courses and the diversity is I want to genuinely believe that the members of these courses want. Well, I'm always kind of curious, like my wife's actually on the admissions committee now, like, and I've asked her, like, what is a club looking for? What are they looking for? And I think if people actually got their heads around what it is they're looking for, they're looking for people who obviously are not jerks, but mostly people who are really like interesting to play, you know, spend 4 hours with on a Saturday morning. Like that to me, at least to me, that's the most interesting. I don't care how, you know, I just want them to play at a decent pace and be an interesting person.
Yeah. But Aaron, you know, I gotta say, you know, we're friends, you know, not everybody is like you. which is fine. You know, I mean, I think one of the things about loving to play golf is you can have a good time just playing 18 holes where all anybody's doing is talking about their game or telling golf stories. But I agree with you. I mean, particularly I'm a journalist. So to me, one of the great things about golf is the opportunity to have, you know, get to meet people and to kind of, you know, have a long conversation about a whole variety of things. And, you know, I've had a lot of those great conversations, some of them completely unexpected with people at Quaker Ridge and other courses. But I also, you know, play a lot of golf. I'm sure we all do, with people who like their only conversation is golf.
Or their materials that they've collected in their garages or, you know, whatever. Things that impress them, but not you. I think that my worldview on what I would want in a perfect country club is different than maybe some of the members, but there isn't really even a dialogue around what it is we're looking for at any of these courses. But I think the big issue that I see being an insider in golf and thinking about inclusion and even things like not even racial inclusion, just like getting my wife excited to play golf and, you know, getting my kids and my daughters excited to play golf and, you know, doing volunteer work with the first tee and getting kids to be interested in playing golf. It's a very formal and stuffy sport, and add insult to injury. I think the big issue with golf is this legacy system at the country clubs.
Mm-hmm.
If I could wave my magic wand, I would love for all these courses to just forget about legacy. I'm okay letting my kids compete on the merits of how interesting they are if they want to join a country club when they move to the suburbs, when they grow up. And I think what's interesting is, I mean, in courses that are newer or there was a big turnover in the 50s or 60s or something like that, those courses are diverse, actually. The courses that have had like very little turnover of the families that have been there, along religious lines, along, you know, just certain ethnicities on Long Island and what have you, those courses, I actually think that they're going to face an issue. They'll always have members, but, you know, the brand changes over time. You know, the kid of a really interesting person isn't necessarily very interesting. And certainly, you know, hasn't had the world experience that three of us have had on this call. Anyway, I just wish the legacy system went away.
Yeah. So something about what you were talking about earlier, what the two of you were talking about earlier, the various conversations. I can actually talk with people about anything on a golf course. I talk politics with them. I don't care what people's politics are. And in my experience,
Mark and I definitely talk politics. Yeah,
my experience is that racism isn't limited to one side or the other in politics. And the absence of racism isn't limited to one side or the other in politics. You talk to people, some people have very positive views about diversity and all that stuff, but they're rooted in racism. They have, you know, the soft bigotry of low expectations and things of that nature. And there are some that have that see injustices and want to attack them and address them and get those injustices addressed. And then you have people that have just these really strong views that could come across as sort of racist, but they don't look at it in a racist context. So I'm able to have a conversation with anybody about anything because I'm going to listen and I'm going to try to be non-judgmental. Now, I will always express what I believe and what I feel, but I'm pretty strongly, my beliefs, I'm pretty strong on whatever my beliefs are, but they're beliefs. So I have no idea whether they're right or not. And so to say someone else's is wrong is I know what I believe and I'm going to live by what I believe and I'm going to stand up for what I believe. But some of my beliefs could be wrong.
At least two. And I'm pretty sure three of the people who I've played the most golf with at Quaker Ridge are really, really conservative. Now, they're more kind of like economic conservative than cultural conservative, but they are hardcore Milton Friedman kind of like, you know, if you know who he is, kind of like guys. And, you know, first of all, my feeling is they like to play golf with me. I like to play golf with them. I enjoy talking to people who have different political views, you know, not only just because I'm a journalist, but I think, you know, we're all better off at least being aware of what other people are thinking and saying. And, you know, it's actually fun. I think to, you know, and they kind of, and, you know, they rid me about being like a big liberal. And the fact is I don't really talk that much about my own personal politics because I'm a journalist and, you know, but their whole, you know, they have a very Fox News view of the world, which is like, oh yeah, you worked at CNN, so you must be left wing. Right. So anyway, but you know, they kid me, I kid them, you know, there's a little bit of that going on. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes it's fun to play golf with people who you agree with. I have, you know, some friends at Quaker Ridge where that's kind of like the fun part of it is like, you know, I know that whatever I've been watching or reading in the papers, they are too. And so we can kind of start, you know, from a base of kind of common reference. But I it's also an opportunity. It's a lot of time. It's 4 hours out there to really be able to kind of like get the perspective of somebody who's, you know, has a different one.
Yeah, I'm working on a book, Mark, and I'd like to, it tells my life story. It's a memoir, and it tells my life story. Your publisher is my publisher, Simon & Schuster.
Okay,
yeah,
great.
But it tells my life story against the backdrop of traveling around the country playing the top 100 courses. And I like to look at the book as a opportunity for people. I want to include enough golf to where people who aren't golfers get a taste of golf and a better understanding and appreciation for golf. Mm-hmm. And then enough about the struggles in our country that people probably wouldn't otherwise listen to, but may in the context of golf, it may find more fertile ground. You know, just coming from a perspective of no judgment, just this is what I lived. And these are lived experiences and the impact these lived experiences had on me. And so people who wouldn't normally get that perspective will likely get it because they'll come for the golf.
Right.
And get immersed in the story. And others will come for the story and be intrigued by the golf. That's the balance I'm trying to strike. But it's a way of exposing different people to something they would not otherwise be exposed to.
That's a great elevator pitch. Otherwise I don't want to read the book.
That may not otherwise be exposed to.
I'll send you one, Mark, because I already pre-ordered like 100 of them from Jimmy. So we're there's one coming your way, Mark. Don't worry. I'm excited to read. When does it come out?
I'm happy to.
Oh, we still got some time. The manuscript isn't even due until the end of the year, so we got quite a bit of time.
Although Jimmy, I'm happy to pay for my own book because I always say to people as a writer, people who think they're your friends want a free book. People who really are your friends will buy your book.
We'll buy your book and buy multiple copies and give them out as gifts.
Right.
To those people who think they're friends.
Right. Yeah. I'm looking at my bookshelf for your book, Mark, that you gave me for free. What are you working on right now, Mark? What's your latest project?
I am finishing. I'm just finishing my latest manuscript. For Simon & Schuster. It's a book about the birth of the Black Power movement in the year 1966. And I was 9 years old at the time. So as I was just becoming aware of like what was going on, you know, at the kind of national level. I sort of grew up with, my family was very much kind of like, you know, early civil rights, you know, family, you know, the marches, the freedom songs, all of that. And originally I was going to write my next book about that. And then I realized that that's just, you know, been written about so much. But then as I was doing research on that, I realized that there's been a fair amount, but not anywhere near as much about sort of Black power and kind of like how that happened, who were the major figures. And so I shared that with Simon Schuster. We agreed, they liked the idea. I got a deal for the book and started working. And basically I spent a whole year of research and I was not out of 1966, which was the year that Stokely Carmichael, if you know who he was, took yep. over SNCC from John Lewis. The Black Panthers were born. It was, you know, really the beginning of the Black arts movement. There was just all this stuff that happened. And so I decided I was just going to write a book about that 1 year and everything that, how like the tide turned in that 1 year. And what's really been interesting about it is that it's still basically about the birth of the Black power movement, but partly because in a reaction to the way in which the civil rights movement changed. Also the reaction to, that was really the second big summer of race riots after Watts. A lot of different factors. You also see this rightward, beginning of a big rightward turn in American politics. A lot of driven by other issues, but really mostly about race and law and order, as they say, but as related to race. And so in 1964, the Republicans had been wiped out. Goldwater had lost in a landslide to Lyndon Johnson. Johnson had filibuster proof majorities in the Senate and in the House. It was like the Democrats hadn't had more power since FDR. 2 years later, in 1966, Ronald Reagan is elected the governor of California. The Republicans take, you know, 10 or so more state houses back. There's a big swing in the House. Richard Nixon, all of a sudden, people who Richard Nixon thought, you know, had left for dead, starts talking about running for president in 1968. So again, most of it is going to be a story about race in America in 1966, but it's also going to be a story about politics in America and how the two are affect each other, which honestly, as I've been writing it, it was like, I've been working on this for 3 years and it was during the whole, you know, George Floyd, the summer of all of that and what we're seeing now with, you know, January 6th and a lot of the divisions we have now, and it just feels like, you know, we're living that history all over again.
Yeah, I just wish both sides would stop saying we need to take our country back. Yeah. You know, it's we need to build our country together, and we need to make America greater than it has ever been. No one should be able to object to that. Make it better. Make America better than it has ever ever been. So one of the things, you know, you talk about history, Mark, one of my favorite lines from the book, I'm at a course, Hudson National, where they talked to me about the gangsters that used to have a course on that property back mm-hmm. in the 20s. And, you know, I just sort of, there and a few other places, I sort of reflected back upon the great literature of the 20th century, the late 19th century, the 20th century. So this is post-Reconstruction, you know, post-Civil War, post-Reconstruction. And you look at the great literature, you look at history. And my characterization of it was, it was written as if we were extras. It was written as if we were silent extras in a movie we were never intended to see. We cannot find we cannot find ourselves. You can find some one-dimensional sort of descriptions of Negroes at the time, Negroes in America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it was it was like it was written as if we would eventually read it and that we were living an experience at the same time. It's like, we were just silent extras in a movie we were never intended to see.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that is starting to change, but certainly for a very long time, if you had Black people in a story, whether it was fiction or even history, it was really because Black people were being saved. You know, they were either being attacked or they were being saved by white people, you know? So it was really, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the Green Book, that movie.
Yes.
Which, you know, and, you know, Driving Miss Daisy. I mean, think about all of these more recent, even recent movies where, you know, really the story is about like the noble white person who saves, you know, or befriends or rescues the Black character. It was interesting to that point. So my last book I told you, which Aaron was talking about, which is about Black Pittsburgh in the middle of the 20th century, the title is Smoketown. And when it came out, it got a lot of nice reviews. But one of them was from at the time, he was the editorial page editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. And he didn't review it for that paper. They gave it to somebody else for that paper. But there was a journal, I think it's called the Pittsburgh Journal Quarterly, that he reviewed it for. And he had this great line in it. He said, because it is a book about Black America, about Black Pittsburgh, you know, it's not, you know, there are white people in the story, but it's, you know, almost all of the figures.
It's the opposite. They're the silent movie of the.
Yeah, they're the silent extras. Yeah.
So this, this reviewer had this reviewer had this great line. He said, "In this book, white people are like grown-ups in a Peanuts cartoon." you know, they're out there. In this case, it's really about, you know. And honestly, the book I'm writing now, that was part of, you know, there are a lot of elements of Black power that we're still living with today. There's a lot of things that I think that they bear critique there, you know, of King's civil rights movement, based on nonviolence and the dream of integration and so forth. They were on to a lot of things, problems with that, you know, even though it was very noble. Why a lot of that, you know, was unrealistic, but it was also about feeling like we can be proud of our own culture and our own community. We don't have to just emulate white people. We don't have to have all of these Black clubs and institutions that are just Black versions of white clubs. Anyway, so you know, I mean, you know, it's. You know, it's very interesting, but you know, honestly, I think you can go a little bit too. I mean, I'm going to be a little maybe politically incorrect here, but you know, I feel like particularly, you know, since George Floyd, I've also seen a lot of white people almost like bending over too far backwards.
Yes,
I would try to show, you know, how much they love Black people or how much they want to, you know, they're embarrassed by their own privilege and they want to be educated about their own privilege and so forth and so on. And, you know, I mean, maybe, you know, maybe some of that is good and necessary, but I sort of feel like, come on, you know, I mean, let's, you know, that's also, and the other thing, the other problem I have with that whole kind of, you know, slightly over, you know, kind of extreme white guilt is that I think it's unsustainable.
I think that will be backlash.
I mean, that kind
it's
of
like
thing,
binge shopping or binge diets. And eventually,
kind of thing like, you know, let's have like these diversity trainers come into our workplaces and tell us how racist we are and so forth and so on. It's not the first time. You see waves of this after, you know, these awful things in the news. Everybody talks about how we have to have a national conversation about race. But, you know, if it goes too far, people are just going to get, after a while, they're going to get, we're sick and tired of this,
right,
you know, and move on, and then nothing happens. So, you know, I think you have to have, like, you know, look,
I was going to say that, like, sort of, like, a corollary to this from the perspective of the white guy on this podcast is, like, I just think, you know, a lot of the tension that exists around race is so misplaced with two white Americans who, so many of whom are like my family, immigrant families that came here so many generations after slavery. You know, it's so interesting. Like, you know, and not to say that I've experienced that in reverse, but it, you know, my daughter's done some volunteering and some charity organizations with inner city kids, most of whom are Black. And she's had some experiences where, you know, I don't know, she feels sort of anger or hate towards her and her ancestry. And she's like a Lithuanian Jew that came over here in like the, you know, mid 20th century. So it's fascinating.
Yeah. I wish my wish for 2022 is that every one of us could dig deep inside and find within us the ability to give as much grace to others as we ourselves need.
Yeah.
That, I think, you know, and part of what you were saying, Mark, I actually became turned off by the idea of inclusion, because inclusion almost says, this is my world and I've decided to let you be a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It sets up a power structure that doesn't really or shouldn't exist. It's our world and we interact together in it, as opposed to someone saying, I'm going to be inclusive, meaning I've got the power and I get to decide whether I'm going to include you or not. It sounds like this really neat idea of inclusion, but when you think about it, there's a power structure that is saying, I'm here, you're there, I am including you. And it's like colored. My birth certificate says colored. And that became offensive, so they changed it. Mm-hmm. And now we've gone back to it, because if you're a person of color, you're colored.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not so much the words as it is our need to appreciate each other and treat each other respectfully. It's not the labels. It's what comes from inside in the interaction with others. And it doesn't matter what you label it. If you don't have the right heart, it's not going to matter.
Just to follow up on that, you know, in our tradition, Jimmy uses the word grace. In our tradition, that doesn't mean just being arrogant or polite.
No.
What it means is realizing on some level that we're all fallible, we're all sinners, but that we're all also capable of redemption, of capable of improvement, of capable of change and growth. And you know, that is, you know, that's what grace means.
Grace allows us to forgive ourselves.
Yes.
So that we too can, so that we too can forgive others, and forgiving others allows us not to feel guilty about forgiving ourselves. That's grace. And so we need to give it and receive. And receive grace. So this has been great.
Yeah. I want to be mindful of both our listeners who probably are bored of our conversation, and also Mark's time. I want to just buy one concluding thought, and then you guys can have yours, is that I think all this being said, golf is a net positive to what we're talking about.
Yes.
I think the three of us have experienced that, which if you were trying to, if you were a social scientist creating an experiment that could bridge some of the differences in America, putting people together at random for 4-hour walks on a course is a pretty good idea.
Yes.
No, and that was certainly not the thought of the Scottish man who invented golf. But I think it's just, I have experienced so much of my life on that golf course. I've met so many wonderful people who have had different experiences in their lives. Diversity, not just of race, but just of different backgrounds and different opinions and different places in their life. And if it weren't for golf, I would never have had that.
Yeah, I would say I agree wholeheartedly, Aaron. My life has been immensely improved because of all of the people I've met throughout my golf journey. And I think golf is, I agree with you. And again, another purpose for my book, I agree with you. I think golf is a place that was once used for segregation, to promote segregation, and is now a place where a tremendous amount of healing can occur. I think we can really move the country forward through just spending time with people on a golf course.
Yep. Yeah.
All I can say is amen.
Yeah. We have some concluding thoughts that we usually do with you off camera, Mark, but I want to say one thing with you here. And I mean this because I don't want to say this behind your back because it's a nice thing I'm about to say. But I just find you to be one of the most interesting people I've met. And I've met a lot of really interesting people. And I think the thing that I find very special about you, Mark, is how low-key you are about the accomplishments you've had that have absolutely nothing to do with race, by the way. The accomplishments you had are unbelievable. Period. And you're so modest about it. I mean, this cranking out book after book and, you know, you'll be late for a golf tee time with me and you're like, I'm sorry, I was just recording, you know, something about reparations for, you know, CBS, you know, but it'll be on this Sunday if you want to check it out. And, you know, like the more I peel away the onion that is you, because you don't come out and tell people and that's that why I love you. I wish more people who are super interesting were as, I don't know if the right word is unboastful, but like just as low key as you are. So it's been very special to get to know you.
Real quick question. There was a great sportscaster with that same last name, Jack Whitaker.
Jack Whitaker.
Yeah. Jack Whitaker. Any ties anywhere in the family?
No, not to him, not to Bill Whitaker, to, you know, it's interesting, you know, White Whitaker, the derivation of Whitaker, or one of the derivations, was, I mean, there were white families and, you know, who probably came to America with that name, but it was also a name that was given to black field slaves. You know, a lot of black families to this day originally got their family names from owners, owners who owned their ancestors. In some cases they didn't even know who the owners were. And so if you worked in the cotton fields, they just called you Whitaker because you worked in the white acres.
Yeah. Wow. But yeah, James is because my great, great grandmother was a slave in James settlement, near Huntsville, right. Texas.
Famous.
Yep. And that's where.
Yeah. My people came from Texas too.
Wow. So we have to get together.
We'll
get together at Quaker Ridge and play some golf. I'm just a train ride away.
We'll definitely do it.
And starting this summer, I'm just a train ride away. So it was great. It was great meeting you, Mark. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah. Thank you so much. Happy and healthy New Year to both of you.
Thank you, Mark.
Wow, Aaron, that was interesting. I hope that our listeners during the month of February for Black History Month appreciate the opportunity just to, for us to have these types of discussions and just sort of reflect upon some of the issues of race, both in our country and within golf. I think it's a safe place to have that type of discussion.
I mean, maybe I'm naively optimistic about the world, but it does feel like for all the problems of diversity with golf, golf is actually probably a little bit out ahead of being more sensible on, you know, just including people than the real world. I don't know. What do you think?
No, I think, so I'll use an analogy. Go to an airport in the newest cities around the world, in Asia, and South America. Go to some airports that got started after the U.S. Now we're redoing LAX here and modernizing it, and the same thing with LaGuardia. But for a long time, we had some of the worst airports in the world because we'd already built them, and sort of renovating them was expensive and a lot of hassle. Whereas people starting from scratch, they could start with a clean slate and build these ultra modern airports all over Asia. There are those.
Yeah.
So the analogy to that is golf had such a dark history in race relations that it gets to start. It got to start later and do some things right to make up for it. Whereas areas that had made more progress before, they're sort of continuing with that progress, but golf had a chance to sort of start with a cleaner slate in terms of moving forward. So I think that makes golf uniquely, as I said earlier, as I said during the podcast, I think that makes golf, gives golf a unique set of circumstances that there's a confluence of things occurring in the country that golf could be at the middle, right in the center of that confluence.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a great opportunity. You know that I personally, every opportunity that I get, I try to promote golf as a more diverse sport.
Yeah. I think I'm doing as best I can there. I mean, but I certainly, it's not just race. I just want more and more people to realize how wonderful this sport is and give it a shot. And, you know, Mark wouldn't mind me telling you that Mark is just a very average golfer. He, you know, the people who, you can love golf and not be shooting 80, you know, he loves golf. He's super fun. He plays fast and, just really cool. I'll say that I've read a bunch of his work, and I would really encourage our listeners, if you like this podcast, to listen to Smoketown. Read Smoketown. You might be
or get it on if it's on audio. Get it
yeah.
on audio.
Yeah. And he's to your point to me about the sort of, you know, just decades and decades of no one writing about what was happening with blacks in America. I thought Smoketown was really interesting because the short version of this is there was a whole derivative community. There was a huge amount of wealth in Pittsburgh in that industrial area, the Carnegies, the Vanderbilts. There were all these huge powerhouse industrialists.
So the steel, and there was the steel.
Yeah, and there was this sort of derivative community that supported it, but the blacks in that community who had chutzpah and ingenuity created massive businesses that supported these massive fortunes that were getting built. Like, there's a whole narrative about a guy who built a tugboat business in Pittsburgh, a black guy, and became incredibly wealthy, you know, and really supported the movement of steel throughout the Central Valley of the US. But anyway, it's a really cool book. And I think he's so modest and he's so chill, but I'm pretty sure that they're working on making that book into a movie right now. So he, you know, the more you get to know about Mark Whitaker, the more fascinating that guy is.
Yeah. No, it was great to chat with him. And I mean, for me, the conversation obviously could have gone on for a long time. And that's why I look forward to us getting together on the golf course.
You got it. Yeah, it's going to be great. I made a list.
At the bar at the end of the round.
Yeah,
me drinking my Coca-Cola, you drinking your
tequila,
your beverage of choice.
Yeah,
but
beverage of choice would be JB Special at Quaker Ridge. JB Special, Jose's tequila drink. That's what I'll be drinking.
Okay,
Jimmy, this was wonderful. Happy New Year. Talk to you soon.
Happy New Year. Until the next time, where we find more golf nuts, or talk to more of the golf nuts we've met along our journey.